Got the gripes again.
How do you write a good magazine article?
Discorder is that magazine published by CITR 101.9 FM. In it, you'll find reviews of concerts and albums, stories about bands and artists, comics, and more, including a comprehensive guide to CITR's program.
In the October issue of Discorder, you can read up on great bands like Aunts and Uncles, Ghost House, and Yukon Blonde, cruise the oral history of Mint Records, and enjoy the fabulous cover story of Shimmering Stars. And don't miss the contributors' meeting September 29th at 6 p.m. in the CITR Lounge. Come one, come all.
Discorder is available all over the fine city of Vancouver. For a complete list of distribution locations, why not go online to discorder.ca.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and this is Eye on
Shindig. Shindig is CITR's annual Battle of the Bands that goes down 9 p.m. every Tuesday night at the Railway Club until a winner is crowned. October 18th, come out to see The Godspot, Honorary MD, and Velociraptor. October 25th, Shindig brings you The Fathoms, From Birch to You, and Rec Center. Read all about it at shindig.citr.ca.
Today is Friday.
Hey, it's Friday.
Today is Friday.
And we're going to do some news.
Today is Friday. Let's restart that, please.
Okay, let's do it again. Do over.
Today is Friday, October 21st, 2011. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Ariel Fournier, and this is News 101 on CITR 101.9, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, the residents of Vancouver, and to all of you on the internet.
Right. This is one of those slow programs. Good evening. It's 5:05, and time for another full hour of independent news, hopefully. Our headlines will cover local news from Vancouver, federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Also today, as part of our human rights segment, Ariel Fournier will be interviewing activist Erica Tafel about uranium mining in Kettle Valley, BC. We also have an interview with an activist at the Occupy Vancouver demonstrations, currently in their sixth day outside the Vancouver Art Gallery.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Republicans, joined by some Democrats, defeated an attempt to separate out and pass a $35 billion portion of President Obama's $450 billion jobs bill Last night, Democrats could not muster enough votes to advance the legislation, which would have paid for more teachers and first responders. Today, Democratic leadership introduced another standalone portion of the jobs bill, a $50 billion investment in the country's transportation infrastructure. Once again, Republicans are expected to unanimously oppose the measure. As lawmakers bicker over the president's job proposal, the Occupy movement continues to gather steam across the U.S. and the world. Australian media report about 20 activists were arrested in Melbourne today. Riot police broke up the protest by about 100 people. In the U.S., Occupy Cincinnati has almost hit the two-week mark. Last night, police arrested more than 20 protesters who refused to leave a city park. An organized event and rally is scheduled for Saturday afternoon. The Bangor Daily News reports that the number of tents in Portland, Maine continues to grow as the movement expands there. And in New York City tonight, the group Parents for Occupy Wall Street are planning a mass family sleepover in Zuccotti Park. To the south, in Florida, police detained six Occupy Tampa demonstrators this morning. They were handcuffed, placed in police cars, and taken away. The protesters were lying or sitting on a public sidewalk and disagree with the police that they were violating city ordinance. For FSRN WMNF Community Radio's Sean Canaan reports.
Tampa protesters had been told by police that they could stay on a stretch of sidewalk between a riverside park and a busy downtown street. But they could not sleep between 6 in the morning and 10 at night. Thursday night, Occupy Tampa protesters decided not to move this morning when police roused them. Before he was detained, Andrew Kovanis said he wants a judge to rule if his arrest is legal.
They're telling us that we have to get off the sidewalk, that we have to be awake by 6 a.m. I find that to be unconstitutional, and I'm here to stand up for our rights. We have the right to a freedom of assembly in a public space. I'm in a public space, and I'm assembling.
After conversations with members of Tampa City Council on Thursday, Occupy Tampa protesters were convinced that they would not be breaking the law by sleeping on the sidewalk during the day. Sean Canaan, FSRN, Tampa.
A hope for a long-term solution to Europe's financial crisis will not emerge from a summit meeting slated for this weekend. Last night, France and Germany warned it could take several more days to iron out an agreement. From France, FSRN's Liam Moriarty explains.
European leaders will gather Sunday in Brussels in what was expected to result in a comprehensive plan to stabilize the debt crisis in the 17-nation eurozone. But key disagreements between Germany and France have delayed a final deal. For one, the countries are at odds over how to strengthen Europe's 440 billion euro bailout fund. Another thorny problem is how to boost the capital holdings of European banks by at least 80 billion euros to reassure stockholders and ratings agencies. The two countries are also at odds over how to handle Greece's massive public debt, which threatens to drag down the other economies in the region. France is resisting deeper write-offs because its banks currently hold a larger portion of Greek debt. Whatever the eurozone decision, the crisis has already had a severe impact on the people of Greece. Yesterday, amid protests by thousands in Athens, the Greek parliament pushed through another round of austerity measures, slashing wages and curtailing collective bargaining rights. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
In Indian-administered Kashmir, the State Human Rights Commission yesterday directed the government to reopen a 20-year-old mass rape case. Indian soldiers were accused of raping more than 30 women during a crackdown in a small village, but none were ever held responsible for the alleged crimes. From Kashmir, FSRN's Shahnawaz Khan reports.
Allegations of mass rape in the village of Kunanposhpura were some of the earliest against the Indian Army after a popular anti-India armed insurgency broke out here in 1989. In February 1991, during a search operation, troops cordoned the village and assembled all men. Then during the night, the troops allegedly entered homes and gang-raped more than 30 women, including some minors and elderly. Villagers registered a case against the men with the police, and despite evidence supporting the claims, the inquiry was closed without any major headway. Now, the State Human Rights Commission has ordered the government to reopen the case. It has also directed action against the official who originally ordered the case closed. The commission cited medical reports confirming rape and violence. The state's Human Rights Commission is a state body with powers of recommendation only. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thank you to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at fsrn.org. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Ariel Fournier. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9, and these are your local headlines. First up, Bush receives rude welcome in Surrey. Former U.S. President George W. Bush was probably not surprised by a welcome committee of approximately 200 protesters who were on hand for his visit to the Surrey Regional Economic Summit Thursday. Dozens of RCMP officers formed a human barricade between the protesters and the Sheraton Vancouver Guildford Hotel, where the summit was taking place. The protest, focused on the president's record on torture, remained peaceful and no arrests were made. Chair of the BC Green Party, Murray Weisenberger, was one of those who felt, in his own words, obligated to protest Bush's visit. He said in case Bush was... He said in... I'm sorry. He said that in case Bush was innocent of war crimes, he should defend himself at an international court. The panel featured Bush and fellow past president Bill Clinton, which was closed to the media and went ahead as planned.
A generation of solid economic growth has meant little in the everyday lives of most Canadians, according to a new index of well-being created by the University of Waterloo. The index suggests the middle class in particular is eroding. The Canadian Index of Well-Being is meant to measure the quality of life in society in the ways GDP does not. Index studies 64 indicators to track Canadians' progress in areas such as community spirit, education, health, environment, leisure, and democratic engagement. It shows that between 1994 and 2008, well-being improved by just 11%, while the economy over that period grew by 31%.
C-SPAN Marine Corporation has won an $8 billion federal shipbuilding contract to construct non-combat vessels that is expected to create 4,400 jobs for the province's shipbuilding industry. The Deputy Minister of Public Works and Government Services, François Guimot, announced this week that BC will be responsible for the construction of the ships over the next 3 decades. The deal is part of a $35 billion shipbuilding initiative, the largest since the Second World War. The company will build at least 7 ships, 4 Canadian Coast Guard science vessels, 2 Navy support ships, and an icebreaker.
The City of Vancouver says the Occupy Vancouver camp in the downtown core has cost the city more than $500,000 since it began last Saturday. Most of the money has gone to policing, which was beefed up for the event in light of the Stanley Cup riot. The bill for the Vancouver police totals $390,000, while it cost another $50,000 to have an RCMP tactical unit on standby last Saturday when protesters first gathered outside the Vancouver Art Gallery. Despite fears of violence, the occupation has been peaceful, and while the number of demonstrators has dwindled since the protests began, the occupation continues to linger with a collection of tents. And now on to an interview conducted by our News 101 correspondent Nina Carigia at the Occupy Vancouver movement currently being held outside the gallery in downtown Vancouver. Nina spoke with Leila Wuil, a freelance writer based in Vancouver. Leila was one of the few speakers who Nina talked to with very specific agendas in terms of government policies in BC that are a disservice to citizens. She spoke about her views on the entire Occupy movement, and she also talked a little bit more about her knowledge on said government policies.
What you think can come out of this and what the first step is to changing things?
I think the first step to changing all of it is for people to really decide what it is that they're going to focus on. Like, this movement is wonderful. It's a spark. It's a chance that I've been waiting for a long time, just to be able to get up and say, look at this. This is what's going on. But people need, I mean, this movement will be good if it can sustain it and if it can narrow down the focus to what exactly is the issue. Because we're hearing here today about 150 different things, and really, I don't, you know, I was worried that we're losing completely the Wall Street corporate greed focus. That's what this rally's about. People are talking about, you know, Aboriginal rights and this, and they're all great issues. But that's not the place for it. This has to be focused. People need to inform themselves.
Thank you.
They need to find out about these things like P3s. A lot of people don't know that we are very close to an economic ruin in this country, and it's because there are so many contracts out there that have been done with the government. And at some point, those payments keep adding up. And if our revenue is not coming in from the government the way it used to, what's going to happen? And it's, like I said, it's not recorded as debt. It's recorded as a contractual obligation. I'm not the only one who's got an issue with this. This has been written about a lot. The Auditor General of BC has taken the government to task for not reporting it as debt either. It's like they're trying to trick the public. Our debt is only this many.
And this is the first time I'd ever heard that, because I don't know, I have no access to that information, but how would people find out? Is there a place that you can look for these things?
Come to my website, and my website is a great starting point to get to everywhere you need. I really, my specialty is P3, so I look at all the contractual agreements. You can go to my best of page and read about everything to do with the Sea to Sky Shadow Toll. I totally caught them in a lie, confidential inside documents showing what they were doing, and the government outright lied to me in a press release. They outright lied to the Globe and Mail when the Globe and Mail covered the story and went national, and it's all there. I've been doing this for years.
What's the website?
www.lailayule.com. That's LailayuIle.com.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. Also, just another question. I mean, once people start to know about that and be informed and, you know, go to your website, figure that out, what can we do to change it?
You can hold your politicians accountable. If you don't know what they're doing, how can you hold them accountable?
Yes.
If you know what they're doing, that's why, you know, there was a lot of people said you shouldn't be speaking about this. You know, they don't want people to know what they're doing, because if you know what they're doing, if you know they're making these agreements, that's your chance to complain, and that's why the public consultation process is so broken in this province. You know, their idea of public consultation is put a little ad in the province this big, and nobody's going to read it because it's on the back of the
sport pages.
Or put it
on like channel 107.
Or a bulletin board in the SkyTrain station that everybody walks by, so they can say, well, we notified you and nobody showed up. And that works on a municipal and a provincial level.
That was Nina Karidja interviewing writer and activist Leila Whale at the Occupy Vancouver downtown. We'll continue with the local headlines. BC Hydro's president and CEO Dave Kopp had quit a little more than a year after taking the job as the Crown-owned utility works towards a cost-cutting reorganization aimed at ensuring power rates stay low. Hydro said in a release that Cobb was leaving to take a job with the Jim Pattison Group, an opportunity Cobb said he could not pass up. His departure comes amid cost-cutting measures being implemented after a government review panel that recommended BC Hydro cut up to 1,200 jobs, among other things.
The BC government has agreed to pay a mining company more than $30 million after it halted a uranium mining proposal near Kelowna in 2008. The NDP mining critic is blaming Liberal incompetence and interference for the costly settlement, pointing to former Minister of State Kevin Kruger. The 2008 amendments to the Mineral Tenure Act issued by Kruger created a ban on uranium exploration and mining in BC. Kruger said at the time the decision supported the commitment of BC's energy plan not to develop nuclear power. A year later, the ministry directed the chief inspector of mines to halt all work on existing claims. Court documents show the government acted against the advice of the Ministry of the Attorney General, which noted Boss Power Corp. had a notice of work that the mines inspector was legally obliged to consider. For more on this issue, I spoke with Erica Taffel. She's an activist from the community near the contested uranium deposit site. The provincial government reached with Boss Power Corp. Is this the worst case scenario? What kind of other ways could this decision have gone down?
Well, I believe that in taking it to civil court, it essentially cut out the citizens and those who live in the watershed's voice. So I think that bringing it, the just bringing a court case to civil court basically was the worst case scenario. I'm not at all surprised with the outcome of the case. I believe that's why it was brought to court, so that the province could negotiate with BOSS privately instead of having to include citizens' voices.
Mm-hmm. And could you just provide quickly a history why they did eventually award this settlement? What was the claim that BOSS Power Corp had over this uranium mine?
Well, BOSS Power Corporation submitted a work order to the government in 2009 seeking an exploration permit. But the government the British Columbian government in 2003 had already stated that it wasn't supporting uranium mining in the province. So, and in 2009, they enacted an order in council, and that order in council stated that the province would not support uranium exploration or thorium in the province. And it's under that order in council that BOSS stated that the British Columbian government expropriated their claim, and they sought compensation for $60 million at that time. So they were awarded $30 million, which is a pretty nice chunk of change for an exploration company that's never done any work at this site.
The contract itself has been handed over to the provincial government for this particular mine, but could other companies that wanted to open uranium mines, could they potentially come in now?
That's a really dangerous precedent, this case, because it throws into question all the other junior mining ventures that have uranium claims in the province of British Columbia, and there are others other than BOSS. So it's hard to know what the motivation of the provincial government is to expropriate this claim, which is essentially what they did. And I just would like to read to you from the information bulletin that was published on October 19th of this month. It says, the legal agreement supports the province goal of ensuring mining exploration is safe, sustainable, and economically benefits British Columbians. So to me, that's a very pro-mining statement, and it isn't the first time that a province has had a uranium mine expropriated, and then the province, actually a federal government, enacts a Crown Corporation who then takes it over. So I don't know if that's what is taking place here, because, like I said, we in having a civil case held, we're not privy to what that agreement is, but that statement to me is very disquieting. It rings like they're supporting mining. It says ensuring their goal of mining exploration is safe, so it doesn't sound like they have any plans on placing a permanent moratorium on uranium in this province. And I would also read from this information bulletin that you can find at the, here I can tell you where to find it, at government.bc.ca/connect, and you can find a copy of it there. But it says in 2003 and in 2007, BC Energy Plan does not permit the production of nuclear power in the province. It doesn't state... That's just the plan. It doesn't state the provincial government's motivations. So I think that, for me, my work, my job here isn't done. I would be satisfied with nothing less than a permanent moratorium, which is not in place at this moment. Under an order in council, we can have that order the province can revoke that order in council without any public debate. So I don't think that we as British Columbians are safe from uranium mining in the province just yet.
Mm-hmm. And what are you trying to do to put the pressure on to get a moratorium in the province?
Well, I've spoken And I would encourage all your listeners to contact, you know, your government representation and ask them what steps they're going to take to ensure that there's a legislative ban on uranium exploration in the province. I should tell you that exploration permits are issued by provincial governments in Canada. So a ban on exploration in any province on uranium and thorium would essentially protect that province from any potential mines. It's the federal government that issues mining permits, and we have an 80-year history of a pro-uranium federal government. Canada was the leading producer of uranium worldwide up until 2009. So if this gets to a federal level, then we can almost guarantee that the mine will go in. There's also an agreement that was signed in 1943 called the Quebec Agreement, which ensures Canadian uranium to the nuclear program of the United States. So when Saskatchewan, which is where the uranium from Canada is coming from right now, dries up, they have an agreement already in place for, you know, 70 years or so, stating that they have to supply uranium to the United States, so they'll just seek it somewhere else. And BC has proven to be rich in uranium, so we can only expect, unless we have that total ban or a permanent moratorium, that eventually the uranium here in British Columbia will be sought. If not by the provincial government, by other junior venture mining ventures.
If we could just back up, what are the issues here with having uranium mining in Canada?
Would essentially contaminate my watershed. They want to put this in the Kettle River, the headwaters of the Kettle River, which is also already a struggling river. It was named BC's most endangered river in 2009 by Marcangelo from BCIT, and but essentially it would contaminate the whole watershed. The Kettle River turns into the Columbia River farther south, and the health issues are, you know, around exploration and mining and milling. They would have to transport this through tourist areas, so the potential for a nuclear accident is very high, and with what's going on in Fukushima, it just continues to get worse, not better. The safest place for uranium is in the ground, and that's what I am trying to keep it safe in the ground, where, you know, uranium is found all over the world, and it does produce some kinds of background radiation for places that have high radiation, but high uranium in their minerals. But that's natural, and that's where the safest place for it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time, Erica.
Well, thank you. And
and can you just let people know again where they can find out more about what they can do to support a moratorium?
Well, you know, I would send my... there's media contacts here in the news bulletin, and so you can contact Jake Jacobs of the Ministry of Energy and Mines at 250-952-0628, or David Townsend at the Ministry of Attorney General, and his number is 250-387-4962.
Okay, well, thanks again, Erica.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Ariel Fournier speaking with Erica Taffel, an activist from the community near Kettle, BC, Kettle Valley, BC, which is the site of a contested and highly disputed uranium mining site. Well, those were your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break and play a couple of PSAs, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia. Stay tuned for more.
2011 marks the 25th anniversary of the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden since opening in 1986. The Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden is very pleased to have been able to connect cultures and communities for the past 25 years and continue being an arts and cultural hub in the neighborhood and the city. Watch for complimentary specials on the 25th day of every month. There are also blockbuster exhibits, community events, academic conferences, and music and theater productions lined up, plus contests and giveaways. CITR 101.9 FM is proud to be a year-long partner as the Garden celebrates its 25th anniversary. For more information, visit www.vancouverchinesegarden.com.
Show your Friends of CITR card or simply mention that you heard about the garden on CITR to receive $2 off admission. The Biltmore Cabaret is your home for great live music in Vancouver.
October is sure to be a busy month at the Biltmore. On October 6th, catch bands Hollow Moon, The Bleeding Hearts, and Pineapple, a supergroup featuring members of the SSRIs, Portage in the Main, and Prairie Cat. October 21st, jam out with Daydream Vacation, indie rocker Zeus, and local favorites Sun Wizard. For fans of the New Pornographers, you won't want to miss band member Catherine Calder and special guest Annamie Bell on October 27th. To round out your month, October 29th brings the band Nurses all the way up from Portland to share the stage with Dominant Legs.
For more information on these and other shows, including how to get tickets, visit BiltmoreCabaret.com.
Welcome back to News 101 here at CITR 101.9, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Next up, we'll have the international headlines. Dozens of youth disrupted a Senate committee hearing this Thursday and then occupied the Senate office building for 8 hours to demand a referendum on how to resolve Chile's social problems, especially education. The activists left Thursday night after getting a promise from opposition legislators that they will introduce a bill requiring a binding referendum, although political leaders on both right and left have said the Chile Congress itself must decide the dispute. To prevent further occupation of the Chile Senate headquarters in Santiago, police sealed off the Senate building with metal barriers to keep more people from entering and faced off with a crowd of about 600 protesters, holding signs demanding reforming the Chilean education system. A few dozen activists tried to force their way in, but were driven back by water cannons. Chilean university and secondary school students have been boycotting classes and mounting demonstrations for nearly 6 months, pushing their demand that the government make extensive changes in Chile's education system, including making public schools free for everyone. Students have been pressing for a national vote because they don't trust Chile's establishment, and the protests have won sympathy for the students from about 80% of the population, according to opinion polls. At the same time, President Sebastián Piñera's support has dropped to between 20 and 30%.
NATO aircraft struck 11 vehicles in an armored convoy speeding late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi out of his hometown of Sirte on Thursday. Although NATO did not know at the time he was in the convoy, it said in a statement on Friday. Gaddafi was captured alive after the attack, but died later while in the hands of fighters in circumstances that are still unclear. The UN Human Rights Office is calling for an investigation into the death of the former Libyan strongman, whose ouster ignited 9 months of civil war. The agency says questions remain about whether Gaddafi was killed in crossfire during a clash or summarily executed after he was reported pulled out alive on Thursday from a drainage pipe in Sirte. Libya's interim government, the National Transitional Council, had earlier told news agencies that Gaddafi would be buried by Friday in accordance with Islamic rites, which dictates that bodies be buried within 24 hours of death. A grave site had not yet been determined.
The Greek parliament approved a painful set of austerity measures on Thursday, defying violent protests in central Athens and a general strike that shut down much of the country. The struggling Greek government of Socialist Prime Minister George Papandreou won the parliamentary vote with 154 votes in favor and 144 votes against, despite the decision on one deputy in the ruling party to oppose one article in the package. The mix of deep pay and pension cuts, tax hikes, and changes to collective bargaining agreements has been bitterly opposed, and at least 70,000 people joined protests in Athens' Syntagma Square in front of the parliament. At least 74 people were taken to hospital with injuries, and one man died of a heart attack on the fringes of the protest. But officials said he had not been hurt in the incidents itself.
The massive flooding in Southeast Asia has taken a heavy toll on the region's children, United Nations agencies said today, with over 200 already having lost their lives, many due to drowning, and hundreds of thousands at risk of missing school because of damage to infrastructure. The floods, a result of heavy seasonal rains and frequent cyclones, have affected 8 million people across Cambodia, Laos and the Philippines, Thailand and Vietnam. To date, 745 people are reported dead as a result of the flooding, including over 200 children. In Cambodia alone, 80 children have died, mostly from drowning. While precise figures are not yet available, the floods are estimated to have damaged over 3 million hectares of cropland across the region. Over 1,300 schools in Cambodia, or 17% of the total, are affected by the floods. Roughly 75% of those schools were not able to open for the new academic year on October 1st, affecting 455,000 children. In Thailand, over 3,000 educational institutions have been affected.
President Barack Obama announced the end of the Iraq war today and the withdrawal of U.S. troops by the end of the year. For more info about this breaking news, we'll go to FSRN News for their clip on this issue.
President Obama announced the end of the Iraq war today and the withdrawal of U.S. troops by the end of the year.
After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over. Over the next 2 months, our troops in Iraq, tens of thousands of them, will pack up their gear and board convoys for the journey home. The last American soldier will cross the border out of Iraq with their heads held high, proud of their success, and knowing that the American people stand united in our support for our troops. That is how America's military efforts in Iraq will end.
The president, who spoke to Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki this morning, said as of January 1, 2012, the U.S. relationship with the country will be between sovereign nations based on mutual interests and mutual respect. At a press conference following the announcement, Deputy National Security Advisor Dennis McDonough said U.S. troops and civilian staff have worked closely with Iraqi security forces to prepare them for U.S. withdrawal.
As we've done very intensively, frankly, over the course of the last 7 or 8 months, a full review of where we stand with the Iraqis, one assessment after another about the Iraqi security forces came back saying, these guys are ready, these guys are capable, these guys are proven. Importantly, they're proven because they've been tested in a lot of the kinds of threats that they're going to see going forward. So we feel very good about that.
Anti-war groups welcomed the move, but some, including Move On, said it's also time to end the Afghan war and redirect funding to communities and programs back home.
For another segment by Free Speech Radio, we'll be talking about the gap between the rich and the poor in the United States, which, as we know, is growing. And those in the working class are having a tougher time making a living. New figures from the Social Security Administration show that half of U.S. workers earned less than $26,000 last year, but those making $1 million or more increased by 18%. For more on this, we'll go to another segment by Free Speech Radio News as they report on the food banks in the United States.
The gap between the rich and poor is growing, and those in the working class are having a tougher time making a living. New figures from the Social Security Administration show that half of U.S. workers earned less than $26,000 last year, but those making $1 million or more increased by 18%. As more workers take home less money and many remain without jobs, it's getting harder to get by. And as FSRN's Linda Perry Barr reports, food banks have become a long-term solution for people to feed their families.
It's a story being told across the United States. In North Carolina, nearly one quarter of all residents reported not having enough money to buy food in the last year. In Mississippi and Texas, it's worse. Those states rank 1 and 2 in terms of food insecurity. The Food Bank of New York City says almost half of all households with children struggle to afford food. Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University, is author of Food Politics and What to Eat. She says what's really happening with hunger in this country is quite shocking.
We don't really call it hunger. We call it food insecurity, which the Department of Agriculture defines as not having access to a regular supply of food obtained through legal means. It's kind of a funny definition. But for the first time in many, many years, we're seeing a big uptick in the number of households and individuals who qualify as food insecure by those criteria.
The Agriculture Department estimates that 17 million children, almost 1 in 4, are food insecure, with limited or uncertain access to affordable and nutritious food. More than half of these children are less than 6 years old. The national charity Feeding America also discovered a new trend in a recently released study. They say rather than using food pantries as a temporary way to get by, people are now relying on them as the new normal, long-term strategies to feed their families.
And that, of course, has to do with the big economic crisis that our country is in, with people not having jobs and not having a source of income. And if they don't have money, they have to have a place to live. Food comes second sometimes. And there's been an enormous pressure on food banks and food distribution places and on food stamps and the government food assistance programs to try to fill that gap.
One of the organizations that tries to fill that gap in New York is City Harvest. Kate McKenzie is their director of policy and government relations.
City Harvest is a food rescue organization, which means that we rescue food that would otherwise go to waste. And there isn't anything that is as sort of simplistic as that, and I think that message really resounds with a lot of people. You know, we were founded nearly 30 years ago by a woman who was working at a soup kitchen and, you know, closing up for the night and saw a restaurant next door throwing away perfectly good food, and she just said this is unconscionable in this time that this happened. So she started with gathering around that food, and now we've grown to, you know, have a fleet of trucks, refrigerated trucks, and, you know, a food rescue facility that will be in Long Island City, to rescuing more than 30 million pounds of food this year alone.
Another staff member, Cruz Quillen, has been driving a City Harvest truck for 4 years. He rescues yesterday's food and brings it to soup kitchens and food pantries. I meet him in front of Zabar's, a food specialty store on Manhattan's Upper West Side.
Just about to pick up food donations right now.
So let's do that.
Right here at Zabar's.
First, I gotta go to the manager, let him know.
How you doing?
Hey, you have anything for City Harvest today?
Yes, I do.
So we're walking through the door, one of the back rooms.
What do you have here for City Harvest?
I got some bagels, some rolls, assorted breads.
Is this what you do every day?
Every day.
Right now I'm about to weigh 3 bags. One is 20 pounds. The next one is 10 pounds. That's so far 30 pounds of food that we could give out to the New York's hungry.
This food goes to Henry Street Cabrini Immigrant Services.
Today we're having just a bit of a breakfast. We're having a cereal, a milk.
David Vasquez distributes pantry bags to Cabrini Immigrant Service clients.
Peaches and cans. Today we have an additive of bread.
So we're rescuing this really high quality food that would otherwise go to waste, and you know, it's an addition to the pantry bags today.
Kate McKenzie and I walk back to where the canned foods and packages are stored, and we find shelves more empty than full.
And the reality is, as you just saw from the shelves in the pantry here, there's just not enough food right now. There's not enough food to meet the growing demand of people.
The number of families facing food insecurity has grown so large that food banks throughout the U.S. are struggling. At the same time, congressional lawmakers have been auditing food programs like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. The House Agriculture Committee says in about 4 years, the number of people applying for SNAP has grown from 26 million to more than 44 million people. Next year, they expect the program to cost nearly $69 billion. Marion Nessel.
This is a substantial taxpayer outlay for people to try to do something about this. And I see this as the absence of federal policy that has left it up to the private sector to try to fill the gap between the money that people have and the money that they need. And we know from decades, centuries of experience, that the private sector cannot fill this need, and that you need federal policies that are going to get people jobs and make sure that their housing is reasonably priced. In addition to trying to do something about food, food's not enough in this situation. People have to have jobs.
Some programs like City Harvest and its umbrella organization Feeding America are making enormous efforts to make food healthier and distribute fresh and canned foods, but they can't keep up with the need. The downturn in the economy has forced cities to curtail food programs as poverty numbers continue to climb. And while food assistance programs have been ongoing since the time of the Depression, they are designed as a stopgap measure, not the solution to the growing problem of hunger across the country. Linda Perry Barr, FSRN, New York.
And that was a segment from FSRN. Those were international headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101 here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Well, right now, News 101 is going to have a bit of a discussion about the Occupy movement currently spreading across the world in more than 1,000 different cities on every continent except Antarctica. Well, I guess those scientists there could protest if they wanted to, don't you think?
Sure, yeah.
Well, we have a new volunteer here, Morgan.
Hi.
Who does not know much about the movement. And so we thought, you know, we might as well have talk to her about it so that, you know, we could fill her in and let her know what's happening. So, to begin with, Ariel, a couple of words from you.
A couple of words? Yeah, well, we're talking about this a bit off air, and I am of two minds about this, because there's some benefits to not having a necessarily one cohesive message or a series of demands.
And in some ways, the inefficiency that they have in these general meetings that most of the movements hold during the day, especially inspired by Occupy Wall Street, they have these general meetings at night, are extremely democratic. In terms of everyone gets a voice, there's no leader, but being extremely democratic also means not getting a lot done.
Yeah.
So I think it's a very inspiring movement for sure, but it is, I can see why sometimes it gets met with a little bit of derision, because there are elements to it that, while the chaos is great and inspiring and endearing in some ways, it means that these financial problems that all these people are pointing to are not getting a lot of proposed solutions out of this sometimes.
Yeah. And for someone on the outside who doesn't know a whole lot about the Occupy movement, sometimes the whole concept behind it is hard to grasp when there's so many different things being thrown at you and you don't get a concise definition of this is what the Occupy movement stands for.
Shrug, you went down to the Occupy Vancouver and talked to a lot of these people, right?
Yes, so. I was there this Tuesday when Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine was visiting Occupy Vancouver. He's been going around. Yeah, he's been going around the different Occupies.
No one person in Occupy is important than any others, though, right?
That is true. That is true. Although there, it was funny enough, there were many people there lining up to get tickets from him, free tickets from him, because he was playing at the Vogue.
Oh, wow.
So if you think about how strange that is, like, he's there at Occupy, a movement that's there to protest about or demonstrate against corporate influence and, you know, about the financial system. And here are people lining up for a free concert playing at the Vogue.
Yeah, it seems like somehow appropriate, though, that they're kind of, like, bypassing the capitalist system. I mean, like, maybe they just protest hard enough so it'll give me some free stuff.
They're saying, like, Tom Morello did not use Ticketmaster, and therefore he's...
Yeah.
But, I mean, I was there. I was there for the General Assembly for an hour, and I love the way they have that mic check system.
You know, do they do the callback?
Yeah.
They do that. So, yeah.
Somebody says something and then the audience repeats it so that people behind can hear it. You know,
Because I guess this was inspired by the fact at the Wall Street protests, they weren't allowed to have megaphones.
Right.
So they do a human megaphone.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
It's an interesting concept. But one of the things that I thought was pretty inefficient, you know, because it takes forever to talk about something. It takes forever to decide on something. It takes, in my opinion, I mean...
Did you see things happen, though, during the course of the meeting? Did things move forward, or was it just...
All right, I can give you one example. Throughout the course of that hour-long meeting, the biggest thing that they were talking about was whether or not to decide on whether the media committee should accept free resources and space and equipment from W2, which is a community arts and community center, mm-hmm. community arts center down on the downtown east side, right? And... So an entire 45 minutes was dedicated to whether or not they should or should not accept resources.
What would be the problem with accepting resources?
Some people within the people who were assembled there disagreed with quote-unquote corporate influence in W2. And despite the fact that W2 said no strings attached, this is stuff we were donated. Mm-hmm. This was donated to us, and we want to donate it to you because we want to support the movement.
And for me, like, saying no to, you know, free supplies sort of makes me question. Well, where do these people get their clothing? Right, like, I mean, unless they're walking around naked or, like...
I mean, there are people donating clothes and sleeping bags and pillows and things like that, but...
But then, isn't there corporate support?
Yeah.
Right? And that's the problem, like, for me, that's the problem behind the whole thing, because it's hard to escape the corporate influence.
Exactly.
And so anyone protesting the corporate influence is still being affected by it.
Exactly.
Right?
That's my point. I mean, my point is that they need to start focusing on the right... on the specific kind of corporate influence that they're against.
Yeah.
They need to focus on corporate influence in the political system. They need to focus on corporate influence in the financial system. And by focus, I mean, call it out. If you see it, you call it out, you know? Tell your politician or whatever your local politician is or your municipal, you know, tell him that this is what you're seeing and tell